There's a lot going on, and we need to talk about it. I'm Melody Barnes, and welcome to The Progressive Beat. When's the last time you said Puerto Rico and election in the same sentence? This week, 55 delegates are on the line in the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico. We'll discuss what's going on there. And we'll talk to Congressman Mike Honda about another group of voters often forgotten, Asian Americans, and the important role they're playing in the 2008 conversation. 82% of Americans think the country is headed in the wrong direction. Why? Chris Mooney, author of The Republican War on Science, will give us his point of view. For others, the country's problems are all about the economy. Housing crisis, credit card debt, gas prices, food prices. Is the 2008 debate getting us any closer to solutions that actually solve our problems? We'll discuss those issues with Nan Mooney, an author, and film director James Scurlock. We'll also spend some time with Peter Edelman, who worked with Senator Robert Kennedy when he crisscrossed the country tackling the problem of poverty. Finally, we'll catch up on the latest on the war and the way America is treating its men and women in uniform. We talk the talk, but do we walk the walk? Join me now for The Progressive Beat, broadcast from the Center for American Progress Action Fund. And now I'm joined by Dan Restrepo, who is the director of the Americas Project at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. And before joining the Action Fund, Dan was a Democratic aide on the House of Representatives International Relations Committee. Welcome, Dan.
Good to be here.
Glad you're on the Progressive Beat. This Sunday, the Democrats have their primary vote in Puerto Rico. And first of all, I'm sure there have got to be a lot of people who are confused. They remember, even though Senator Obama told us there are 57 states, they remember there are 50 states. Puerto Rico isn't one of them. Why a primary in Puerto Rico?
Well, in a year full of kind of political peculiarities, here's another one that you have one of the it's a commonwealth is the status, the official status of Puerto Rico. And in 1980, the Democratic Party decided to include Puerto Rico and other U.S. territories in its primary process. And like a lot of other places, that nobody really noticed that they were part of the primary process until this oddest of odd years of primaries that have taken us to the very end of the process. So the Puerto Rican Democratic Party is putting on a primary on Sunday, and they're going to cast their votes for 55 delegates to the convention in Denver.
Which I think is interesting because Montana and South Dakota, which will be the last two states to vote in this ongoing odyssey that is the Democratic primary season, actually will have fewer delegates combined than the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico.
Yeah, it's odd that the Puerto Rico has this many votes in the process. But again, it's a waiting process within the party. And Latino voters are very important in the Democratic Party. And I think part of what you see with giving Puerto Rico a voice in the primary process and giving it what is relatively a large voice is a function of that, is that the Latino vote is important in the Democratic Party particularly. And obviously the population of Puerto Rico is heavily Latino.
Well, it's also interesting that even though people on the island of Puerto Rico will get to vote in the primary on Sunday, that when it comes to November, only people in the mainland, only people in the United States will actually be voting.
Right. And there are important pockets of Puerto Rican vote in the mainland United States.
Absolutely.
In New York, in Chicago, in Orlando, Florida, kind of looked beyond
Disney
in
World.
A lot of ways. Disney World, indeed. So there are important pockets of Puerto Rican vote that will have a voice in the November process. But those on the island of Puerto Rico itself only get this one shot, albeit a very important one because it's here at the end of this crazy process. To participate in selecting potentially the next president of the United States.
Well, and it's got to be very exciting to be in Puerto Rico right now because President Clinton has been there, Chelsea Clinton has been there, Senator Clinton has been there, Senator Obama has been there, Bill Richardson, who's been a surrogate for Senator Obama, has been there. A lot of attention. Why so much attention now? And what are they talking to the voters of Puerto Rico about?
Well, I think they're talking to the voters of Puerto Rico the same topics they've been talking about everywhere else. The people in Puerto Rico are worried about education, about health care, about retirement security, about the economy writ large, the war in Iraq. So the topics of conversation are very similar in Puerto Rico as they are anywhere else.
But do you think they're also talking to them about statehood in Puerto Rico?
I think they're being very careful.
Or are they trying to dodge the issue of statehood in Puerto Rico?
They're trying to dodge the issue of statehood. Puerto Rico is of three minds on the question of statehood. There's there's an independence movement that is represented by roughly a third of the population on the island. There's those who are happy with the current Commonwealth status, which is roughly another third of the population, and then the final third that wants to be a state of the United States. So it's an issue that really has no clear political benefit to pick one side or the other. So I think people have been pretty careful to kind of straddle the fence and not really go there.
What do you think that people hearing that will say, well, if two-thirds of the people of Puerto Rico don't even want to be a state of the United States, why are they getting to vote in this primary process? Or have people not thought about it because they haven't even thought about Puerto Rico being a participant?
Yeah, I don't think people have given a lot of thought to Puerto Rico participating in this process. And also, it's been a long, strange road we've been on. And, you know, why not the Puerto Ricans vote in the primary process, given how odd it has been to this point? So I don't think a lot of people have given a great deal of thought that if two-thirds of Puerto Ricans don't want to be part of the United States, officially part of the United States, I mean, you can actually look at it that two-thirds do want a relationship with the United States, mm-hmm. either it is statehood or in the current Commonwealth status.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think a lot of people have given a great deal of thought to why is it that Puerto Rico gets a voice in this mm-hmm. process? I think people at some level have just thrown up their hands. It's such a strange process. We've gotten
they've just said, let us just get to the end of it at this point.
Become the theater of the political absurd. Why not Puerto Rico participating in the process at this point?
Well, you were talking about the issues of conversation being the same as they are all over the United States, education, healthcare. And that goes to the point, I think so many people think, oh, the Latino vote, you know, what is it that Latinos care about, as though there's some segregated set of issues that Latino Americans care about, and as though Latinos all over the country care about or thinking about things in the exact same way. Myth or fact?
A pure myth that there is some sort of Latino bloc that sits around and decides on behalf of all Latinos the issues that matter and how they're going to vote and how they're going to participate electorally. The Latino community actually should be described as the Latino communities in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And folks in the Southwest have a different set of issues that are important to them than people living in the upper Midwest to the Northeast to Florida. And those are all places with large Latino populations that are going to participate in the electoral process. So it is a myth that there is an Latino electorate out there that is deciding on distinctly Latino issues, whatever they may be. These are folks who are living side by side with the rest of the Americans and who are concerned with the same issues. Yes, some issues are slightly more important to them, immigration and the manner in which the immigration debate has been handled because it has become so anti-Latino. But kind of beyond that threshold issue, the issues that matter to the Latino communities in the United States are the same issues that matter to voters writ large in the country.
And I would think education. I mean, recently, I guess it was a few weeks ago, 2 or 3 weeks ago now, there was a report about the growth or the size of the Latino population under, I guess, like the age of 5 or so. You know, just a boom in terms of young Latinos in the United States. Education has got to be an incredibly important issue.
Absolutely. It's a much younger, demographically, the Latino community in the United States is much younger than the country is as a whole. One out of every two new Americans at this point, half of our population growth is attributable to Latinos, and most of that to Latino births in the United States, not immigration.
Right.
So, yes, the issues that speak to the future, particularly the education issue, is of paramount importance within the community. In poll after poll, you see that is one the thing that galvanizes the community's interest the most are where politicians are on those issues that are future-oriented mm-hmm. and that particularly impact a community that is much younger than the United States is as a whole.
Well, a couple of minutes ago, we were talking about the fact that, you know, Senator Obama, Senator Clinton, everyone had been there. And beyond the fact that it's got to be more fun to campaign in Puerto Rico than it is in, you know, some other parts of the country. I'm not going to name any names, any particular states. But Senator Clinton, with whatever polling has been done, seems to have a lead there, which seems to raise the same old question, the same old saw. You know, is it that Latino voters won't vote for an African-American candidate? Do you think that's what's happening here, or is it name brand recognition because of all that she did while she was in the White House as First Lady? What's happening here?
It's a combination of things. It's not that Latinos won't vote for an African-American candidate. At large measure, it is brand recognition. President Clinton was very popular in Puerto Rico, remains very popular in Puerto Rico, so the Clinton name and brand are very strong. Also, Senator Clinton's campaign from the very beginning was focused on the general election. And focused on Latinos and Spanish-speaking Latinos in a way that few presidential campaigns to date have been, and certainly earlier than others.
Right, she was smart.
She's been a real presence on Spanish-language television, Telemundo, Univision, and those are outlets that are watched religiously, if you will, in Puerto Rico. So she has been present, not directly campaigning in Puerto Rico all along, but her campaign has been present in Puerto Rico, on the airwaves in Puerto Rico, in a way that Senator Obama's campaign, frankly, has not been. And you combine the brand and the presence over a long period of time, I think it only makes sense that Senator Clinton is likely to prevail in Puerto Rico.
Well, Dan Restrepo, head of the Americas Project at the Center for American Progress Action Fund, I want to thank you and for bringing your insight to the Progressive Beat. Thank you very much for being with me today.
It's my pleasure.
And now I want to welcome Congressman Mike Honda to the Progressive Beat. A native Californian, Congressman Honda has been in the House of Representatives since 2001, representing much of Santa Clara County. And he currently chairs the Congressional Asian Pacific American Caucus. Welcome, Congressman Honda.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. Congressman Honda, as I was thinking about your experience, it occurred to me that your life really reflects the highs and the lows of the American dream. You serve in Congress in high elected office. You were an educator both in the public school system as well as at Stanford University. Your children are quite successful. I'm sure you're very proud of that. And yet you spent your early years in an internment camp in Colorado during World War II. And I'm wondering if you could tell us a bit about your recollection of your family's experience there and how that shaped your thinking about issues of race and ethnicity in the United States.
Sure. Thank you. I don't have too much of a recollection of camp itself since I was an infant, but I do remember and recall things through dreams, and I used to share that with my parents over the dinner table, and they would look at me like, oh, this kid's strange.
Because you were remembering something that they thought you couldn't?
I recall these things, and when I shared it, it was pretty accurate. But the whole life of this person has been based upon reflections of what I saw since I could remember things. And I do remember my parents having a rough time keeping our family together, but never understood where the conflicts came from. And they were young folks who were pretty much frustrated with what had happened with their lives since we were ripped out of our homes and sent to camp. And so they are not unlike a lot of Japanese-American young couples who had certain dreams about going to school and then having to change that direction because of taking care of a young family in a society that was still pretty angry about towards Japanese Americans and Japanese in general. And so in spite of the fact that we had a great war record and our community had complied with the order to evacuate Executive Order 9066, there was still a lot of anger in our community, and I think as a young person, I saw this anger expressed as I grew up and seeing people being upset or being quiet or not wanting to attract attention to themselves. So, but what I did learn is that once we understood who we are and we started to understand that we had to get a grasp of our own history, and we took a lot of lessons from the civil rights movement. Seeing folks expressing themselves in nonviolent ways and watching the violence be visited upon them. Our violence was pretty quiet and was pretty subtle, but nonetheless is very deep and harmful for a lot of the Asian Americans growing up because there was an issue of self-esteem, even though we had this model minority stereotype.
Right, right. And that stereotype certainly persists.
Sure.
And yet, even as your community was politically active, even given the fact that you suffered injustices during that period and going forward, there still hasn't been a lot of attention paid to the Asian American community. And I'm thinking about that in particular in the context of this election cycle. There are a lot of conversations about race and ethnicity with regard to African Americans and Latinos and the white community and the perceived and real tensions among them. But Asian Americans have been left out. Why do you think they haven't been a part of this conversation or the media coverage?
Well, let's reflect that for a moment and pretend this is my dinner table again, and we have our parents listening. And, you know, historically in this country, especially in California, the media had always depicted Asian Americans as a group that wasn't to be trusted, and that drove us underground and made us quiet. We just didn't want to attract attention. The media, according to Randolph Hearst, his job, he said, was to shape public opinion, and they did. And that's what allowed this government and the people of this country to allow Asian Americans to be evacuated without a whimper. And I think today that sense is still existing in different ways. I think that because we're not more vocal and not present in numbers, I think that the media does not pay attention to us. But the other thing is that the media has grown up to a point where they understand different communities, so that they should also have that responsibility to pay attention to other communities, especially in California and New York. Asian Americans exist there in greater numbers than in the past. We're appreciative of the Asian American community. It sometimes slips their mind, and we have to give them notes to say that.
Well, I'm sure you're incredibly effective at doing that, given your own experience in politics and in California. And I really hope that people are listening to the message, the media, as well as the community and politicians listening to what you have to say. And I want to thank you so much for being on the Progressive Beat today.
Well, thank you. And it's through programs like this, Melody, that allows us to say that more often than not, and remind people that when you say African Americans, Latinos, you say Asian Americans, Native Americans, and people with different sexual orientation, we know that we can all say that in one breath.
Absolutely. We are one community. Thank you
so much,
Congressman Honda. Soon, you and I will have the opportunity to discuss the way state ballot initiatives might determine who sits in the White House and the Congress in 2009. Remember, in past years, Republicans used gay marriage initiatives to great effect. This year, states including Colorado, Florida, and Arizona will vote on affirmative action, immigration, workers' rights, and more. And recently, there's been a lot of talk about what could be the big one, a gay marriage ballot initiative in California. Talk show host and gay marriage supporter Ellen DeGeneres recently discussed this issue with, and asked a favor of, presumptive Republican presidential nominee John McCain, who opposes gay marriage.
We just have a disagreement, and I, along with many, many others, wish you every happiness.
Thank you. So you'll walk me down the aisle? Is that what you said?
Touché.
I'm thinking the answer will be no, although watch tomorrow's Ellen to find out what the recently married first daughter, Jenna Bush Hager, said when Ellen asked her if she could borrow the Bush Ranch for the ceremony. I wonder if the president knows. Anyway, in the coming weeks, we'll have a chance to discuss the politics of this issue, how it's viewed by California voters, how it may affect voter turnout, and how it could shape support for candidates at the top of the ticket. And now we get to speak with someone who is going to do for all of us what our ninth grade science teacher could not possibly do. And that's make science interesting and let us know why it's important. We have author Chris Mooney on the Progressive Beat today. And I do have to say this, Chris, I'm going to give you a little bit of a hard time. One of the reasons that you probably make science so interesting for people is because Wired Magazine apparently named you one of the 10 hottest geeks. One of the 10 sexiest geeks. So that's another honor that you've got on your list of honors. Welcome to the Progressive Beat.
Thank you. Good to be here.
I want to talk to you about science and what you have coined as the Republican War on Science in your New York Times best-selling book. You know, when I told people that you were going to be on the show today, they said, you know, science, you know, we've got a war, there are all the problems with the economy, our housing crisis. Why are you talking about science and why is that important in 2008? And my response to them is that, in fact, science affects all of those things. The attack on fact-based information is an attack and that prevents us from leading with our strongest foot when it comes to dealing with issues like our economy and like the war. How would you respond to them?
Oh, I think that science underlies many political issues. I don't know how directly it underlies the housing crisis, but if you look at the war in Iraq and you look at one of the justifications for invasion, it was that if you recall the aluminum tubes, they were supposedly for centrifuges and therefore, you know, the enrichment of uranium, only they weren't. And the scientific analysts knew that they were actually for more conventional rocketry, and the Bush administration ran roughshod over that and misused the aluminum tubes as one of the grounds for going to war. And it's just one of many, many ways in which science has been twisted, distorted, misrepresented by the administration, and in this case in service of yet another bad policy.
Well, and I think going to that, and there are a number of other issues, the fact that this particular administration continues to try and use that information, and even when it's been disproven, to support a particular point of view. So it's not just using a fact at a particular time to try and advance their argument, but it seems to, there seems to be a complete disregard for science and for fact-finding. Is that part of what you were thinking about when you started writing your book, the Republican War on Science?
Yeah, absolutely. There's certain bodies of science, certain aspects of it, certain fields in particular, that really don't gel very well with the way the Bush administration thinks of itself and what it wants to achieve. And what we found is that with this particular administration, more than others, there is this sense that if the information is a challenge, there's some way of managing it, almost from a public relations standpoint.
So it's more about PR than it is about facts.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, the president will find a way of seeming to say something that, you know, acknowledges some of the science, but not all of it, and the scientists are angry, but the people in the White House must think, oh, this is good enough, and we'll get away with this, and this will prevent him from being asked too many uncomfortable questions about it, like global warming or something.
Well, and I think that's a perfect example. I mean, and what really drives me crazy is that there are so much evidence of game playing. I mean, there's, you know, the game playing around issues of contraception, around the stem cell debate, the fact that they've reduced money for scientific research for 4 years in a row, and certainly the example that you just mentioned around global warming, the fact that the White House took information out of the congressional testimony of their head of the Centers on Disease Control, and then what's going on with Steven Johnson and the EPA, which is actually pretty hard to imagine.
Yeah, you know, honestly, you can't even keep track of all the stories.
So many. You aren't keeping a tally somewhere in your house?
No, I mean, I stopped a long time ago. You listed some of the new ones. I'm like, I thought you were going to list different ones. There's so many, and that's the point, right? And it's been actually done in a statistical way by the Union of Concerned Scientists. They've been polling scientists at government agencies, and sure enough, they find that a large proportion of scientists at, say, EPA report political interference with science. And so now we're talking about hundreds of employees at the agencies have had these kinds of experiences. So it's systematic. It's government-wide. And we know the most egregious examples, like someone tries to muzzle the most famous climate scientist, James Hansen, and he speaks out, and so we hear about that. But it's a pervasive phenomenon.
Well, before we go on, I just want to remind people that they're listening to The Progressive Beat, broadcast live from the Center for American Progress Action Fund. And our guest is Chris Mooney, who's the author of The Republican War on Science, and he's also a senior correspondent for The American Prospect. I mean, Chris, you were just talking about that Union Concerned Scientists survey, and I think it's something like 60% of 1,600 EPA scientists say that in the last 5 years, they've had their work interfered with because of politics. And then we know that Stephen Johnson at one point supported a piece of information based on the science, California's ability to try and get a waiver to lower emissions and deal with the issue of global warming. And after a meeting with the White House, he was pulled back and changed his mind. How often do you think that is going on? And how do you think we should engage with the people who are either putting forth bad information or the people who are sitting in the administration who are undermining our ability to deal with serious problems?
Well, gosh, at this point, the administration is sort of winding down. So I think everyone feels that whoever's the next president, the government probably won't be staffed in such a way that you have it quite as many of these kinds of problems. So in some sense, engaging might not be as good a plan as sort of running out the clock. But generally, I think that there's a lot of hard questions to ask about how it got this bad.
What are some of those tough questions?
Well, what is the role of scientists in combating misinformation, the sort of systematic misinformation that exists on scientific topics? I feel like they tend to sit on the sidelines when they really ought to be more engaged.
And do you think that they do that because they think there's no use or because they think that politics and policy doesn't touch them? And particularly at this point, why do you think they're on the sidelines?
Well, they view politics as a messy thing that they don't want to get their hands dirty with. And on some level, one doesn't blame them. They also tend to be a bit naive about just how serious and strategic and, in many cases, well-funded the enemies of science actually are. But in any event, and there's no reward for the average scientist to go out and engage in some sort of public affairs battle. That's not how you get career advancement in science.
Well, as we're wrapping up, when you think about McCain and Clinton and Obama, how should they approach this issue? What should we be thinking about in terms of their candidacy and 2008 going into 2009? Should we be looking for who can stand up to the heat and actually deal with science fairly?
Yeah, and in some ways, there's good news and bad news here. I expect that any of the three, if president, based upon their histories, their stances, and all the rest, probably wouldn't see nearly as many science scandals as under the Bush administration. For example, McCain has been quite good on global warming. McCain has served on the Senate committee that has dealt with a lot of science issues over a long time. I expect McCain to be the kind of guy that takes science a lot more seriously than Bush. On the other hand, none of them have agreed to debate science on the presidential campaign trail as an organization that I helped to start up. Science Debate 2008 is asked them to do. So they clearly don't want to get into it on that really high of a level. Among the three, I think Clinton has clearly shown that she is the biggest wonk on science policy. She knows the most. I don't think that says that, you know, the others couldn't, you know, brush up and get up to speed if they had a good science advisor and all the rest.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for your thoughts on that. I hope that, I think for all of us, it's important to pay attention to these issues and make sure that those tough questions are answered. I want to thank you for being on the Progressive Beat. And for those who are interested on what Chris has to say, check out his work on Science Progress, www.scienceprogress.org, or on his blog, The Intersection. Thank you, Chris Mooney.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
We're back at the roundtable with Nan Mooney and James Scurlock. Nan is a journalist who set off to answer a very interesting question. Why are so many college-educated, middle-class people struggling financially well into their 30s and 40s? And based on what she learned, she's written a new book, Not Keeping Up With Our Parents, The Decline of the Professional Middle Class. And James, and I love James's story, he is an author and a filmmaker who actually didn't have formal filmmaking training, but he managed to direct and produce an award-winning film called Maxed Out. And Maxed Out examines the debt that's choking both the individuals and our country and looks at the relationship between consumers and the financial industry, the president and Congress. So Nan and James, welcome to the Progressive Beat.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it was interesting to me, both the film, James, that you did, and the book, Nan, that you've written, involved talking to hundreds of people, lots and lots of people, about their experiences. Nan, I'm just wondering if you can tell us something about the people that you met and what you learned after talking to them, what you learned that you didn't know before.
Well, I won't say this came as a big surprise, but I talked to over 100 people, single people, people in families ranging in age from their 20s to their 60s, really, although most were in their 20s, 30s, and 40s. And what was amazing to me was that they are all college educated, they all had good jobs, and they were all working very hard. So I think there's this sort of myth in our country that if you get a good education and get the job skills and work hard, you will be financially comfortable. And just speaking to people from all over the country, you know, from major cities to smaller towns, this just wasn't happening for them. And it wasn't a question of them being lazy or making foolish financial choices, but of the economy just not serving them anymore.
Right. I mean, I think there's a sense from people that, you know, people who are in trouble are out buying big screen, flat screen TVs and, you know, taking expensive vacations. But that isn't the case.
No, I didn't find that to be the case at all. And people had run out of ways to cut. They were actually being very circumspect, and I think were more financially responsible than most people would expect.
And like you said, Nan, the economy has taken such a hit, and the middle class is so severely weakened now. You know, there's been little income growth. You know, debt has gone up. People are using their credit cards just to get by and declaring bankruptcy as a result of that. And James, I want to draw you into the conversation because that's what you seem to focus on in Maxed Out.
Yeah, and it's not what I intended to focus on. I intended
to
focus on what you said, which is, I think, what's still the conventional wisdom that people are irresponsible, or, you know, that it's all about people making bad decisions or even just being bad people. And what I found was that the behavior of the financial industry has changed much, much more than behavior of individual Americans over the past generation. And that behavior is, you know, has gone from being very responsible to being tremendously irresponsible.
And what's interesting to me is that it's been a few years now since you wrote and directed Maxed Out, but things have gotten so much worse. We've had the subprime mortgage crisis, and now we're actually looking at a similar problem that may be brewing in the credit card industry. Are you surprised by that?
No, not at all. I mean, you know, that's what I found. That's what the book and the film were really about. And people would ask me, well, you know, what's the solution or what's going to happen? And I would say, you know, the solution is for Wall Street to shut these companies down because they're making very, very bad loans and they're making very bad decisions, and eventually it's going to come back and haunt them, you know, maybe destroy them. And that's exactly what's happened. And the trends are really pretty bleak right now. I mean, Bank of America just did a study and found that they actually track how people spend money on their credit cards, and what they're finding is that people are spending now on the basics on their credit cards.
Right, healthcare and groceries.
And healthcare, groceries, all that kind of stuff. And it's the, you know, the vacations and the Prada shoes or whatever, that's going way down on credit card usage. So people have really, really started to depend on their credit card, which is the bank's own fault. I mean, they've advertised that.
Well, one of the things I remember being surprised about is the fact that credit card companies advertise and send information to people who've already filed for bankruptcy, people who they already know are in pretty bad shape. And that just seems stunning to me. But, Nan, go ahead, James.
I mean, it's shocking.
And, Nan, have you found in talking to the people that you interviewed, you know, people who thought they would be doing really well, they've got college degrees and, you know, they come from the middle class. Are they angry? Are they embarrassed? Are they surprised by the circumstances they found themselves in?
All three. And there was really a lot of shame, which I think is very unfortunate, surrounding the whole financial circumstances, because people still feel like it's something I am doing wrong or something our family is doing wrong, and what did we miss, and where did we spend where we shouldn't have spent, or what investment didn't we make, or, you know, could we have screwed up so badly when we've ostensibly done everything right and we're still having trouble paying our mortgage, or, you know, putting any money aside for retirement or covering health care, all these panoply of things that they can't pay for that they assume they would be able to pay for. And I think one of the big things I wanted to do in writing the book was to take the veil off all this and to say, you know what, everybody is struggling.
Right.
Nobody is making it. It's much bigger than you just spending too much money on your daily latte.
Right, exactly. And, you know, you're having a problem. Your neighbor could be having a problem, too. And I want people to know that you're listening to The Progressive Beat, and I'm speaking with author Nan Mooney and film director and producer James Scurlock. You know, James, one of the things that you mentioned is the fact that, you know, what you were talking about, what it would take to change all this. And we're in the middle of this debate in 2008. And in fact, Congress has just started taking a look at what needs to be done with the credit card companies and the way they advertise. Is it possible for real change to take place, given the relationship between the Congress and the industry and the White House?
Well, you know, there's two relationships. There's the relationship in terms of the lobbying and donating to campaigns, and that's a very powerful relationship in itself because these companies give a huge amount of money to the candidate. The second relationship is a little more subtle, which is that so much of our economy depends on financing right now. You know, we went from being a production economy, an industrial economy, to a service economy when Reagan was in the White House, and now we're edging towards this financial economy where companies like GM and GE and even Target more and more are making most of their money just from financing stuff.
Right. It's not making things, it's financing them.
Yeah, so, you know, if you're a congressman or woman and, you know, a politician, you're going to be very, very hesitant to come down too hard on this industry.
Right.
Then producing all of this cheap credit that makes college educations possible and financing cars. I mean, look at the car industry now. It's just completely imploded. The housing industry. Well, what makes all of that tick? It's financing and debt. So you're going to be very hesitant to come down too hard on the guys who are making all that happen.
I had that experience when I was working on the Hill as a Senate staffer and watching people, you know, try and balance and walk that line because of the influence of the industry. I mean, Nan, just in wrapping up, I want to ask you, you know, given the slightly dire picture that James painted for us, because of the frustration and the anger that people are feeling, because you're putting some light on that, do you think that the public will be able to push people or push the legislature, push Congress to make a change? I mean, just very quickly as we wrap up, what do you think?
I hope so. I mean, I think we're at a critical time right now, and the economy is becoming, I mean, this sounds like a horrible thing to say, but in a way, the economy getting worse is a good thing in terms of people pushing for change because they are having to tighten their belts and there's no more notches.
Right.
And so they're going to really, I hope, get out there and vote and push their Congress people and their local governments for the kinds of changes they need just to get by.
Well, I want to thank you for that. I hope people are paying attention and listening to you. I want to thank Nan Mooney and James Scurlock for being on the Progressive Beat. You've shared a lot of helpful information with all of us. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Melody.
And now we're going to spend some time with one of my favorite people. He's also one of the most interesting and talented people I know, Peter Edelman. Thank you for joining us on the Progressive Beat.
Glad to be here.
The path that has led Peter to his current job as a professor at Georgetown Law School, I think, is really incredibly interesting. He was a legislative assistant to Bobby Kennedy. He was issues director for Senator Edward Kennedy's 1980 presidential campaign, and he served as assistant secretary at the Department of Health and Human Services in the 1990s. And despite all that, my guess is, from what I know about Peter, that his favorite accomplishment is that of being a grandfather to some of the most beautiful grandchildren I've ever seen on Christmas cards.
Absolutely right.
Peter, I'd like to start out by remembering the fact that this is the 40th anniversary of Bobby Kennedy's presidential campaign and all of the work that you all did in the 60s working on poverty. And I think with both Bobby Kennedy and with President Kennedy, there's always a sense that if they'd had a little bit more time, they could have gotten it done. And the it in this case is the work around poverty. What were you all trying to accomplish in the 1960s?
What Robert Kennedy was about really was to get everybody included in our country and indeed across the world, because he wasn't just interested in the United States. He traveled to South America. He traveled to South Africa. He had a sense that must have been there from when he was really a child, a young person, for those people who were not included fully in the society. So it wasn't just about money. It was really about people being a full part of American society. He was deeply devoted to civil rights. And he was really the person who started the thinking toward what became the war on poverty. It started in his office as Attorney General. And his biggest part on that was what came to be called maximum feasible participation. That is that people who were going to receive the help would be in control of the policy.
So it isn't just that there are poor people who were victims and poor people who needed the government to help them, but there are poor people and the working poor who would actually be a part of the solution and part of the change.
He believed very strongly in what we've come to call has become a buzzword too often, but empowerment, yes, mm-hmm. That people at the grassroots really ought to have the say in what was going to happen in their lives and ought to be empowered to do that. And that the government's role, and there would be a government role,
right.
was to enable them to do that.
And we speak of the government role, but in the reading that I've done, and in fact one of the books that you've written on this topic, there is also a role for the business community, there is a role for the government, there is a role for the not-for-profit sector as well. How did all those pieces come together?
RFK really started a politics that I think we lost lost our way over the 70s and the 80s. I think we see it now back in a lot of what Senator Obama is saying in his candidacy, Paul Wellstone, whom we miss so much.
Absolutely.
And that was really this idea that it started from the bottom up, and secondly, that everybody had to play a role, so that there's a civic responsibility. We're about not only building individual capacity and responsibility, but communities. That's a very key word in RFK's thinking. So, yes, the business community, the faith community, labor, everyone, ordinary people who would come together and make a difference.
And I think that's interesting because there's a perception, and you mentioned what happened in the 70s and 80s, but there's a perception that, you know, there's the welfare queen and ending welfare as we know it because people were lazy and shiftless. And then there was Katrina and people saw something that was really shocking to them. And I think it's important, at least for me, to recognize how people have ended up in poverty, the circumstances that got them there, and the fact that poor people and the working poor are active in terms of trying to get the kind of change that they need in their lives.
There's so many people who are poor because they have personal problems or personal incapacity. But basically what's happened in our country even more now than 40 years ago is that the labor markets are broken, that people are stuck in low-wage jobs and really, it's not their fault. It's the way the whole economy is structured. And that was something that Robert Kennedy instinctively understood. Whether with him it was more how many young people, especially young people of color in the inner city, had no chance at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was very critical of the existing welfare system. He really wanted to see jobs be the center of the policy. But he was different from some of the modern critics, some of the people who talk Ronald Reagan with the welfare queen, in that he thought there needed to be a safety net at the same time. But the center of it for him was always jobs and the education that would lead to jobs.
Well, how do you think that we can build on the idea and his legacy and create this narrative that helps people understand that this is a work-based agenda that needs to be put on the table and needs to be acted upon?
It's a combination of leadership at the national level, state and local, and people, again, speaking for themselves. We need to have an organized voice as we go ahead. If we have a president who is committed, as I hope we will, to making these kinds of changes going forward, he or she is not going to be able to do that without having people all over the country saying, this is what we want to happen.
And what is the this? What do we want to have happen? What do we need to have happen?
This is a combination of jobs that pay enough, and sometimes there's going to have to be some public policy that adds to that, certainly in terms of health coverage, certainly in terms of child care for those who need it,
mm-hmm.
help with the cost of rental housing, and a decent safety net, and then investing in our children. Investing in the future. Those are the key things to make this happen.
Well, I want to remind everyone that I'm speaking with Peter Edelman, who's a professor at Georgetown Law Center and was also an aide to Senator Robert Kennedy working on his anti-poverty agenda. And you're listening to The Progressive Beat. Peter, you've talked about some of the critical things that we need, jobs that pay, child care, and you also mentioned the fact that we need a president who's going to enact that agenda. How do you think this issue is playing out on the campaign trail right now?
We've had more conversation this year, I'm pleased to say, about these issues, about the people who are left out, which, by the way, goes way beyond the number who are technically in poverty. There are something like 90 million people on up to twice the poverty line who have trouble making ends meet every month. And we have to understand that the agenda is not just the people whom we call poor. It is those people, but all the way on up. And then
right, it connects to the middle class as well.
It very much connects to the middle class. There's no bright line between the two. And then we just simply need to get a conversation going where we are dramatizing these facts.
Right. Right, and putting a human face on the facts.
Absolutely putting a human face on the facts, making it clear that all of these generalizations that we have made, all of these characterizations, all mm-hmm. these bumper stickers are oversimplified, and that there's a human story in every case.
Well, Peter, as we wrap up, given that point, what is the one thing or the two things that you would want people to understand about this issue, or the new president to understand when he or she goes into the Oval Office?
One thing is how much of the problem that we have in this very wealthy country is because people don't have a fair share in the prosperity of our country, and indeed there are others who are not paying their fair share in the cost of running the country and in the benefits that they get from this great country. That's the very basic thing. And the other is that at the end of the day, people have to be responsible for themselves, and that what we should do with public policy and all of our partnerships is to help people take responsibility for themselves, for their children, for their community.
Absolutely. Well, Peter Edelman, professor at Georgetown University Law Center, thank you so much for being on the Progressive Beat with me today. And if people want to learn more about this, I say go to www.americanprogress.org and learn more about this work on poverty and read some of what Peter's written. Peter, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And now we're going to talk about an issue that drives me crazy. The way that we treat our men and women in uniform, both abroad and at home. There's always so much conversation, so much rhetoric from members of Congress and the White House as they pledge their support to the men and women who are in Iraq, who are in Afghanistan and other hot spots around the world. But the true test for our support for those men and women is how we treat them when the fighting is done and the tools that we give them and the places where we put them to serve the United States. You know, both my father and my uncle served in the military, and both of them went to college on the GI Bill. And in fact, when I was talking to my dad recently about this, he said, not only did he say, yes, I used the GI Bill to get my college education, he said, thank goodness for the GI Bill. And now we find that the GI Bill that's in place, the program that's in place, isn't doing all that it should do for the men and women who should be the beneficiaries of it. In fact, it's startling and shameful that just recently we had to claw our way to a decent vote, to getting a vote, to pass the 21st Century GI Bill, a bill that would expand the education benefits to make sure that those, when they return home, actually have the money that they need to go to college. This is, in fact, an investment in those men and women and their families. In fact, I think of myself as a beneficiary of that bill. If my father hadn't been able to get his college education, I certainly wouldn't be able to get the benefits that I've had today. And that's why I found it really upsetting when I heard Senator John Cornyn, a conservative from Texas, in the debate last week say the following.
I know it's not his intention, but Senator Webb's bill actually would encourage people not to reenlist by providing a perverse incentive to leave early in order to obtain the benefits they would receive after 3 years of service.
That was Senator Cornyn talking about the Webb-Hagel bill, a bill that would make sure that GIs had all of the benefits that they need to go to college, a public or private institution of their choosing, after they serve in the United States military. What he had to say, that those weren't the facts. Senator Tester actually responded with the facts.
Some have said that the Webb bill will hurt retention, especially in the mid-career officer corps. This is simply untrue. A commissioned officer would have to serve 8 or 9 years before being fully eligible for the new enhanced GI benefit. Madam President, that is not the GI Bill that causes mid-career folks to leave the military. It is 15-month deployments, or multiple tours, and stop-loss and voluntary deployment extensions, the so-called backdoor draft.
given everything that Senator Tester pointed out, the way that we're treating the men and women who are serving in Iraq, who are serving in Afghanistan, from the very beginning, not preparing them adequately to go to war, and then, in fact, increasing the number of men and women who are over there, not giving them the proper breaks that they need to restore themselves and to be with their families before they have to go back into those hot spots, I think Senator Durbin actually asks us, he actually reminds us of the key question that all of us in the United States should be asking ourselves.
You know what happens when a nation goes to war, when America invades a country as we did in Iraq? I can tell you. We love our soldiers when we send them to war. Our hearts go out to them and their families. We honor them while they're serving in that war, some unfortunately losing their lives and some coming back injured. We honor them with our speeches and all of our attention. Senator Webb, with this GI Bill, asks the basic question, will you honor these soldiers when they come home?
Will we honor these soldiers when they come home? And also, will we honor them when we've sent them into places of war? Today, I'm speaking with Matt Dust about this issue. Matt is a research associate with the Hyde Park Project at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. Welcome, Matt, to the Progressive Beat.
Thank you.
Matt, as I said, we had to claw for a vote on the GI Bill. But once it happened, we got a big vote of support, an overwhelming vote of support on the Webb-Hagel bill. But the White House still opposes it. What do you think is going to happen next?
Well, I'm not quite sure what's going to happen next, but I think what really needs to be made clear by supporters of this bill is, A, that the GI Bill, the original GI Bill, is generally regarded as one of the most successful government programs in American history. It by allowing our GIs and our veterans to go to college to get an education and then enter the workforce, it contributed to the massive growth of our economy in the 1950s and 60s. And but, you know, the benefits of that bill just haven't kept up with inflation, and what's available now is just not allowing people to go to college. It's not giving them nearly as much of a paying nearly as much of their tuition as the original GI Bill did.
But with the big vote that we got in the House and the Senate, it seems as though we should be able to override a veto by President Bush.
I would hope we can. We're not quite there, but it's important to understand how much support this does have. It has over 300 co-sponsors in the House, almost 60 in the Senate right now. But I think it gets to the real question of where this administration's priorities are, and John McCain has allied himself with the administration on this issue. And let's understand that McCain is opposing this bill, Bush is opposing this bill, and yet both of them want to extend their upper-class tax cuts. They're saying that we don't have the money for this, and they're also bringing up this argument about retention.
Well, and I think going to that very point, you make a good one, that they say they can't support this bill, but at the same time, this bill costs a fraction of what it costs to keep our troops in Iraq and to build up, to have built up the surge in the way that we do.
That's absolutely right. And I think they keep pointing to this CBO report, which talks about the likelihood of people leaving the armed forces in order to take advantage of these new benefits. They say that this bill could potentially decrease re-enlistments by 16%. However, the same CBO report projects that the new benefits would increase enlistment by that same figure, by 16%. So I think that's a false argument that's being made.
Well, and you make a good point, but at some point, you know, in the next week or two, this issue will probably be behind us. What still remains in front of us is what's happening in Iraq and what's happening to our troops in Iraq. It's not on the front pages of the paper as it has been for the last few years, but there's still a surge. There's still an inordinate number of troops there. What's happening and what's really working and what's not in Iraq?
Well, I think we need to recognize that there has been a significant drop in violence, and I think we all welcome that after the last 4 years of just extreme violence and sectarian civil war. I think there were some phenomena that were occurring in Iraq, which did not begin with the United States military, but I think General Petraeus has been good at kind of looking at that, the strategic environment, and helping to support some of those processes which were occurring, by which I mean the Sunni tribal revolt against al-Qaeda. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem as if any of these tactics are contributing to a viable Iraqi state. I mean,
which is the reason why we said
exactly
we were there in
the
first place.
That was the goal of the surge, and we have to understand the goal of the surge as presented to the American people was to create space for a political reconciliation and the creation of a viable and legitimate Iraqi government, which exercised a monopoly over the use of force throughout the country. And by empowering these Sunni militias who owe no allegiance to the Iraqi government, these deals have been made directly with the United States military. We're not seeing these kind of political accommodations and agreements and negotiations going on that could lead, I think, to a future viable Iraqi state. So the reality that we have here is that the United States, we've created a situation in which it seems as though American soldiers will be required to stay in Iraq for the foreseeable future.
Well, Matt, we have to wrap up in the next couple of seconds, but what's the message that you would want our listeners, the American public, to know with regard to Iraq right now?
I think that right now we have leverage with the Iraqi government, which is our presence and the threat that we would leave. And I don't even if we said we were leaving right away, but right away we mean about a year from now. But I think we need to make clear that we are not going to stay there forever. We are leaving, and they need to get their political act together. They need to make these agreements with each other, dividing power between Sunni, Shia, and Kurds. And we can work with them to the extent that they're willing to work with that goal of ours. But I think there are a lot of Iraqis who are very suspicious of the continued U.S. presence in their country. They're very suspicious of what the U.S. designs on their country are, and we need to make very clear to them that we're not going to be using their country as a base for the projection of U.S. power throughout the region.
Right. We've got to get it done,
That's
in
right.
other words. Well, Matt Dust from the Center for American Progress Action Fund, I want to thank you for being here with us today.
Thank you very much.
This week's hot ticket in Washington, D.C., the Nationals baseball game, the Dixie Chicks or a Jay-Z concert? Nope, it's the May 31st Democratic National Committee Rules and Bylaws meeting, and it is open to the public, everyone. The big question, what's going to happen with Florida and Michigan? Will their delegates be seated at the Democratic convention? Will their vote count toward the popular vote totals for Senators Obama and Clinton? Those who are betting think the end result will include a partial seating of the delegates. Next week, two important events take place. South Dakota and Montana vote and bring the Democratic primary season to a close. I know, can you believe it? And the Senate will also take up the Lieberman-Warner climate change bill. The votes on that bill may tell us a lot more about those who want to be president. There are differences between them. Pay attention. And thanks for listening to The Progressive Beat with Melody Barnes, broadcast from the Center for American Progress Action Fund. That's www.americanprogressaction.org.